Okay, so John DeGroff, filmmaker and author. So John is our resident happiness advocate, quality of life preacher, and community organizer extraordinaire. So welcome, John.
Thank you. Thanks very much. And thanks especially to Karen for making this wonderful conference happen, and to Helena for her insights and her inspiration, and to everybody who's been a part of this. There's so many I know who've done something. So thank you so much. I want to start. I've had the great pleasure of now sharing a cottage with my old friend Michael Abelman, who is going to speak to you tomorrow. And he's, I think, on the last panel, so stay around because you will really appreciate what he and Vicki Robin and others have to say. But being with Michael reminded me of the time when he and I visited my own personal hero, a man named David Brower, who built the Sierra Club as an organization, founded Friends of the Earth. And I had known him for 28 years before he died in the year 2000. But 5 days before he died, Michael and I had the opportunity to visit David in the Alta Bates Hospital in Berkeley, California. And it was the last time, of course, that we saw him, and he was clearly near the end. And but I'm this kind of optimistic person. I like to cheer people up. So as we left, I said, "Well, David, I hope that the next time we see you, you'll be healthy again and out there fighting the good fight." And he looked me straight in the eye. I will never forget exactly what he said. And he said, "I don't think that's in the cards, John, but it's been a great 88 years." And I think that's what we all want to be able to say whenever our time comes, whether we have 88 years or 100 or 50. So I think when it comes to happiness, David Brower died a happy, a satisfied man. But he also died a very worried man. And in his last years, he used to give what he called his sermon. In this sermon, he would take the age of the earth, estimated at about 4.6 billion years, and he would compress that into 1 week. Into 7 days. I'm going to compress it into about 1 minute for you right now. But anyway, if you do that, a year is about a day is about 650 million years. An hour is about 27 million years. A minute, 450,000 years. And a second is about 7,500 years. So you can do the math. So Earth formed on Sunday morning, the first day. And by Tuesday, the first life forms, very tiny form, and they become ever more wondrous in the next few days. And then on Saturday, early in the morning, the seas are filled with all kinds of wondrous creatures. You know, amazing-looking creatures that we now find as fossils. And about noon on the first day, Saturday, these big reptiles, the dinosaurs, appear on the earth. They thunder on the land and fly through the air. And they have a long run. They last until somewhere between 5 and 6 o'clock in the evening of the last day of the week. About 3 minutes, before midnight on the final day of the week, Homo sapiens arrives, that's us. Again, final day of the week, 3 minutes before midnight. At roughly a third of a second before midnight, Buddha is born. At a quarter of a second before midnight, Christ is born. At about 1/30th of a second before midnight, this thing we call the Industrial Revolution begins in the mid-1700s, where we can actually start using these fuels and things and make stuff. And about 1/100th of a second before midnight on that final day, the age of what I call affluenza shows up, and the consumer society after World War II. Now, during that last 1/100th of a second, that blink of an eye in geological time, we have managed to consume more resources than all human beings who ever lived in all of history, all put together, did before that. We have reduced our soils, our fisheries, and God knows what else by half, our forests, and we are dramatically changing the climate. And Brower says there are some who say that what we've been doing for that last 1/100th of a second can go on indefinitely. In fact, they're considered normal, reasonable, intelligent people. They run our corporations. They run our governments. but in reality, they are stark, raving, mad. We can't grow on like this. And so we've got to change, and that's what I'm going to talk about, is about how we change. I think you know that we have to get away from GDP and that it would be better if happiness were our goal. But given that knowledge, the big question is, how do we get there? So in the next few minutes, I want to talk about a few things. Quickly, the science of happiness, particularly due to the leadership of Bhutan. Relocalization as a progressive answer to the globalization crisis, political polarization as an obstacle to change, and finding a possible route forward, just one of them, toward both relocalization and greater happiness. But first, I want to start with a metaphor that I draw from personal experience, and I like metaphors, and I call this one the backpacker's theory of life. When I grew up as a kid, my father took me backpacking. I lived in San Francisco. He used to take me to Yosemite, and he taught me how to backpack, and my friends too. And so by the time we were 14 years old, right after our first year of high school, my dad could take us up to Yosemite and literally drop us off. And each summer, we would spend 3, 4, even 6 weeks in the mountains by ourselves, no parents, just backpacking around, hitchhiking from place to place, and so forth. And what do you learn when you're backpacking? Well, you, and in fact, everything that I've done in the area of quality of life and things comes from this experience as a backpacker. So what do you learn when you're a backpacker? Well, you learn first, you can't take too little, because if you don't have certain things, we went a couple days sometimes without food. Wasn't fun because we didn't plan well enough. You get cold if you don't have enough to keep you warm up in the mountains some nights when it may snow in August. And as I found out at the age of 14, if you forget mosquito repellent in late June or early July in the mountains of California, you get eaten alive. And that's not a pleasant thing either. So you can't have too little, but you can't have too much, because if you have too much stuff, you have to carry it on your back and you're miserable. So you've got to find this big thing we call balance, and you have to plan, and you have to understand what, in fact, is enough. You learn some other things. You learn that you don't need too much to be happy. You need friendship and companionship on the trails, a wonderful thing. You need healthy exercise, which you get plenty of when you're backpacking. You need nature's beauty. And I'll go more into this concept of beauty, but we were surrounded by the glorious beauty of Yosemite and those kinds of places. You need time, and you understand the value of time, so you're not rushing all the time as we do in our lives. And you understand the value of freedom. You are actually free in this place to make certain kinds of choice, especially as a 14-year-old and a 15-year-old without your parents. There was a lot of freedom involved. Hopefully we didn't abuse it too badly. Now, these are all the things that Bhutan, through its work on gross national happiness, has learned are essential for happiness. They brought in experts to tell them that. But I think of the United States as a backpacker. I want you to think of this way. As a backpacker who keeps trying to pile more and more and more stuff into its backpack, getting it bigger and bigger. How many of you have seen the film Wild with Reese Witherspoon? So you know this scene where she's starting out on the Pacific Crest Trail and she's filled her pack with everything she thinks she might need. And she then puts the pack on and steps to get up from the chair, and boom, she falls over backwards. And this pack is so tight that the straps are so she can't get out. So she's like a beetle turned on its back, or a turtle that can't turn itself over, and it's just flailing, upset, and oh my God. Finally, she extricates herself from this situation. But this is what we are like as a country. We are piling so much into our backpack that we cannot make progress or go forward to a positive or happy future. And in fact, we are being pulled backwards, falling over backwards, and we are angry as hell. And we are fighting with each other and blaming each other and blaming everything except the problem itself for our situation. So I think in a sense, relocalization, which has been Helena's theme for many years, is about health, good food, social connection, and sustainability. It's about a backpack in balance. And it's not only localization. We do need some things from other parts of the world. We can share and we can learn, but we've gone way, way too far. And yet, despite many noble efforts, our country seems to be moving in the opposite direction toward more corporate power, less democracy, and more of this stuff. We just gloated, Trump just gloated a couple days ago, that for the first time in a long time, we hit 3% GDP growth. Yuck. Okay. So we are now deeply polarized, left, right, urban, rural, race, gender, all of these things. And we have what I call the false localizers, like Trump, who in the name of anti-globalization want to turn back all progress, give corporations and the rich unlimited rights to plunder and fill America's overstuffed backpack even more, America first, et cetera. This is often done under the name of anti-globalization, but it's fake. It's fake news, fake localization. Now, it promotes growth rates, as Trump claimed, of 5%, which were it possible to achieve that, and as Richard pointed out, it isn't, at least certainly not for long, would double our consumption and our environmental impact in a little more than a decade, with nearly all the gains, as we understand, going right to the top. We can't grow on like that. It's not fair, it's not sustainable, and it won't make us happy. So what can we do to break this impasse? We can't continue just to give people continual messages that the sky is falling, because it doesn't work. George Lakoff and others have shown that if the message is constantly this kind of negative scare thing, people don't get active, they get passive. They get more passive, and deniers become more resistant in their denial. So this is where I'm going to get to what I'm about now, and this is where a man named Doug Tompkins comes in. How many of you have heard of Doug Tompkins? There are a few hands in the room. How many of you have heard of the company Esprit? A few more. Okay, how many of you have heard the company North Face? Ah, even though Esprit was much bigger, but North Face. So Doug Tompkins is the guy who started North Face, and then he started the great clothing company Esprit. But he got sick of selling things, and he sold Esprit, and he used that money to buy enormous amount of land in South America, which has now been turned over to the countries of Chile and Argentina as the world's largest national park. But one of the things that Doug died 2 years ago in a kayaking accident, a terrible tragedy in Chile. But one of the things he always used to say was, if anything can save the world, I'd put my money on beauty. And I think he's right. At least I think this is a hypothesis we can begin to test. So that's what I'm trying to do now. I got interested in this and making a film in the city of Nevada City, California, the town of Nevada City, California, where the so-called rednecks and the so-called hippies, who had been fighting each other for a decade and a half, came together, got together to work to protect the beautiful Yuba River that runs north of their town, to stop a power dam, and to create a wild and scenic river. And in coming together over the beauty of this place, they learned to talk to each other. They learned that there were other values and things that they shared, and they have built an amazing, sustainable, and fascinating community. They don't always agree with each other still, but they are civil, they are respectful, and they have found ways to work together. And that's one of the things that I think beauty does. It crosses political lines. It is not in the eye of the beholder. In fact, one of the most universal things we know is that people perceive the beauty of the natural world and even built cities and stuff in remarkably similar ways all over. But what does beauty do? It makes us want to protect it, to reproduce it. It opens our heart. We learn this from the science. It makes us kinder, more compassionate, more just, in fact. There's a book called On Beauty and Being Just by Elaine Scarry, a Harvard professor, that really points this out, that actually beauty makes us care more, not less, about a fair world. And the word fair, which means both beautiful and just, comes from the same root. It promotes sustainability. I just had the opportunity to speak with a fellow named Herman Knoflocker, Vicky knows him, who is the director of transportation for the city of Vienna, Austria. And he told me that when Vienna beautified its metro stations, made them more varied, made them full of art and things, ridership doubled, and interestingly, crime around those stations was cut in half. Now, pretty petty crime, but nonetheless, it was cut in half. And then when they separated the routes to get to these stations and put paths with trees and things and separated them from big streets and from where all the cars were, people were willing to walk three times as far to take metro and to give up their cars to do so. And they measured their cortisol levels. And they found that, in fact, the stress levels of people were dropped as much as half to two-thirds. It also, I think, reduces the need for consumerism, because as we interact and care about a beautiful world, we're less inclined to have all of these products. Pope Francis said, if we approach nature and the environment without this openness to awe and wonder, if we no longer speak the language of beauty in our relationship with the world, our attitude will be that of masters, consumers, ruthless exploiters, unable to set limits on their immediate needs. If someone has not learned to stop and admire something beautiful, we should not be surprised if he or she treats everything as an object to be used and abused without scruple. It also promotes, I think, a localized focus. And I think we can think about how do we make our communities more beautiful. It leads us to ideas around environmental restoration, community revitalization, and healing the rural-urban divide, which is so serious in this country. So let me ask you to imagine something. We have a lot of coal miners. They're unemployed. Trump has told them that we're going to deregulate those coal, and they're going to be able to mine, you know, ad infinitum as long as they want, and it's fine and dandy. But it's not going to happen. Number one, it's bad for the environment. We all know that. But number two, the market isn't going to sustain it. And so what do we tell those coal miners? Well, if we're the Republican think tanks, we say, go get a U-Haul. Move somewhere else. Move to Seattle, you know, where there's a lot of jobs. And if we're Hillary Clinton or the Democrats, we say, well, get a U-Haul, but wait a couple of years and get some IT training in the community college first, and then move to Seattle or someplace else. But these people can't sell their homes. They can't go to these other places. They don't have these jobs waiting for them. And they've lived in these places. They're connected with these places. They don't want to go. And they are, in a way, the unhappiest and unhealthiest people in America. West Virginia and Kentucky are the two unhealthiest and unhappiest states in the country. But we owe it to them to give them a chance to do this differently. We need to change the narrative, and here's why. Because we as a country, not you and you and you, but we as a country wanted coal. We asked them to dig it. We got lots of our electricity from it, all of those things, and they gave it to us, and they sacrificed their health, and they sacrificed their happiness, and they sacrificed their lives. They're the shortest-lived people in America, except perhaps Native Americans, all to do that. So what if we instead turn this around? What if we bring back the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, for example, and we pay coal miners not to dig more coal, but to, in fact, to restore the 530 mountaintops that have been stripped. And we can do this. We can do this, and coal miners are starting to do it themselves, and they simply need help. What can cities be if we emphasize some of the kinds of things and bring to scale the things that Will Allen is doing in Milwaukee or Michael Howard in Chicago or these urban farms that are wonderful? I need to move on here. So I want to, Sarah Van Gelder, for example, in her book shows some of the great projects that are going on that I think we can help bring to scale. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We had a whole decade in which this country focused on beauty. It was the 1960s, and it was Lyndon Johnson, and I know a lot of us remember Lyndon Johnson just for the Vietnam War. But there was another side. It was the side that actually, in the Great Society speech, really questioned not only GDP, but said that we were burying beauty and community and all the values that we held dear under unbridled growth. Those are exactly the words that Lyndon Johnson said. He said, we need to stop. He said, your imagination, your initiative, and your indignation will determine whether we build a society where progress is the servant of our needs or a society where old values and new visions are buried under unbridled growth. Expansion is eroding the time-honored values of community, with neighbors and communion with nature. The loss of these values brings loneliness and boredom and indifference. Lyndon Johnson, 1964. He said, "For centuries, Americans have drawn strength and inspiration from the beauty of our country. It would be a neglectful generation indeed, indifferent alike to the judgment of history and the command of principle, which failed to preserve and extend such a beautiful heritage for its descendants." So we've started a campaign. I'm almost finished here. We call it And Beauty for All. And I'm happy to tell people more about it, and you can look it up, and we have a Facebook page and other things. We're moving it along, and we are going to promote these kind of ideas because we think that this actually can make a polarized country come together to talk about some of the positive things that we can do. We're going to celebrate what we call And Beauty for All Day, sort of to launch this in a big way, next October 2nd. October 2nd is the 50th anniversary of the date when Lyndon Johnson signed four of the most significant beauty acts legislation in our country's history. One of them very close to us, the North Cascades National Park, signed that day. The Redwoods National Park in California. The National National Scenic Trails System Act, which the Pacific Crest Trail and many others are part of. And finally, the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, which allows communities like Nevada City, allowed them to protect their rivers from dams and so forth. So that day, we want to call that And Beauty for All Day. We want to celebrate that 50th anniversary. We want to remind ourselves of all the things that were done in the 60s. I don't have time to go into them, but it's amazing. And I'll send you all of this stuff if you want it. So really, when the poet Vachel Lindsay, some of you may have heard of him, walked from Springfield, Illinois to Santa Fe, New Mexico in 1912, preaching what he called the gospel of beauty, he commented on the vibrancy of rural communities and farms, especially in Kansas, with its great golden wheat fields, and he celebrated the democratic agrarian life in our rural communities. In his The New Localism, which he wrote, Lindsay argued that every school should train its students to leave their small towns briefly and learn from the world outside, but then return to serve them. And 60 years later, another poet, Gary Snyder, who lives in Nevada City, suggested that parents should teach their children to find a good place, stay there, learn the biology, grow things, and create community and permanence. Localism and beauty, I think it's a winning combination. Let's test it out. Thank you.